בפה לנשיקות שלך, מפנה מקום מסביב לשתיקות שלך, מפנה מקום בלב ללחיצות שלך, מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך, אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dan Raviv, who is a national correspondent for CBS News and was formerly the CBS correspondent in Tel Aviv. He is the author of several books, including the 1990 bestseller Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, Friends Indeed, Inside the U.S.-Israeli Alliance, and his latest, Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, all co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Raviv.
Ian, a real pleasure to be with you.
And the president is in Israel. He's met with Peres. He's meeting later today with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He planted a tree from the White House, a magnolia, in President Peres' garden. Now, he's also visited the Iron Dome anti-missile site. But I guess the headline, if you will, is what's happening vis-a-vis the chemical weapons. It came up in conversations with Peres, where he talked about Hezbollah getting hold of chemical weapons and what a catastrophe that would be. And also the Israeli justice minister, former senior intelligence official Tzipi Livni, said it's clear to us here in Israel that chemical weapons have been used in Syria and that an international response should be on the table. Now, that's been refuted by Netanyahu spokesman Mark Regev. So what do you understand is going on here, Dan?
Well, okay. Hi, Ian. We'll start with the Syria issue, which I think is sort of a stepping stone to the most serious topics, which are the possibility of Palestinian-Israeli peace and how to stop Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. But the Syria civil war, of course, cannot be ignored and would not have been ignored. The Israelis usually point to it as evidence that the Arab countries right now are so volatile that you should not expect Israel to make concessions and be in a rush toward negotiating peace. That's generally been the right-wing Israeli government's point of view, saying Egypt is in turmoil and Syria is in flames, we can't do anything. And this week, we get the chemical weapons issue, where each side in the civil war is accusing the other of using chemical weapons. U.S. intelligence is reluctant to confirm that occurred. Israeli intelligence also apparently reluctant, because as you say, one cabinet minister said, yes, somebody used chemical weapons, but the prime minister's office won't confirm that. But let's say it did happen. It would be something that brings the United States and Israel together. They both have said it violates a red line. It would destabilize the region for the Syrian government or anybody to use chemical weapons. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that U.S. or Israeli commando troops might enter Syria and seize those weapons. There would be action, but I think the bottom line is this, Ian. It's one of the issues that brings Obama and Netanyahu closer together. Some issues divide them, but Syria right now actually holds them together.
Even though it's out of control.
Well, they're not sure whom they favor. And, of course, you've noticed that the United States government, unlike some of the Europeans, doesn't want to send weapons to the rebels. The U.S. Government is just not certain who the rebels are. Some of them seem to be Islamic radicals who would be anti-American. And I have to tell you this, for a couple of years now, I've been asking Israeli intelligence officials, what do you think about Syria and whom do you favor? And they have been confused. It is one of the few topics where Israeli intelligence and the government don't know what they want the outcome to be. They don't like President Assad of Syria, and he, of course, hates Israel, but they figured him out years ago, he and his father. They must have the Syrian regime totally eavesdropped upon, totally monitored. And so the Israelis were kind of comfortable with the stalemate up there. The Israelis hate the current situation with a lot of dangers and insecurity. So they're not sure whom they favor at all.
Well, of course, the rebels, or at least a good part of them, accuse Assad of having been an Israeli agent, in effect.
Well, them saying that, of course, underlines that those rebels are very anti-Israeli, and by extension in the Middle East, that usually means you might be anti-American. So the United States isn't sure where it stands either. I mean, again, the Syria issue had to be brought up, and it might involve U.S. and Israeli joint action, but keep in mind that Syria's government has been very close with the Islamic Republic of Iran for many years. And in the Israeli view, you know, that's the big issue in the Mideast. And I think Barack Obama is coming around to that, too.
Well, but that raises the paradox, doesn't it, Dan Raviv, that if you intervened, or the West intervened, or Israel, or both intervened in Syria, it would be probably a blessing for Tehran. I mean, isn't the reality is that if Tehran loses Syria, it'll expose Hezbollah and basically reverse the so-called Shia Crescent. It will be a massive geopolitical reversal for Iran, or for this government of Iran.
Well, Ian, a lot of officials here in Washington, where I'm sitting right now, want Iran to be dealt a punch in the nose, you know, a major setback. And so they want the Syrian government to go down, but they're concerned about who would replace that government. Now, again, Syria is not the most important country in the world. And if Syria, you know, is run by Islamic Brotherhood followers, the U.S. probably can deal with that. They're dealing with an Islamic Brotherhood member who's the president of Egypt right now. For a lot of people, that punch in the nose to Iran would be the most powerful thing, and also weakening the Hezbollah faction in Lebanon, which, you know, has amassed tens of thousands of rockets for the next round between Lebanon and Israel. We had a war there in the summer of 06, and Israelis certainly think there's likely to be another round of warfare against Hezbollah at some point.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Raviv, a national correspondent for CBS News and formerly a CBS correspondent in Tel Aviv. He's the author of several books, including the 1990 bestseller Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, Friends Indeed Inside the U.S.-Israeli Alliance, and his latest Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, all co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman. Now, the president said today in Israel that across the region, the winds of change bring both promise and peril. And clearly, Israel's position strategically is very, very much affected by the Arab Spring. And it could get worse, particularly, for example, if the royal family in Jordan were to fall. How much do Israelis, because I think this is basically a public relations trip. There's not much policy going on. From what I can tell, it's in Netanyahu's interest to repair the relationship and make it clear that the U.S. and Israel are on the same page. And equally, I think Obama wants to repair the relationship because he has a problem with Congress. So if it's about PR and not about policy, how much do you think the Israeli people, I've heard that they in some ways blame Obama for what's happened in terms of the Arab Spring, in other words, giving permission to the Arab Spring, if you will.
Being too soft, not supporting Mubarak when he was president of Egypt, that sort of thing. But I have to disagree with your premise. I actually think that, almost like an iceberg, this Obama trip to the Middle East has 90% of its reality beneath the surface. I think there's a lot being discussed, including talking about what's going on with Iran's nuclear program, how best to counter it, reaching understandings over that. I believe that in the private talks between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and they did have the talks and had a brief news conference afterward, that new understandings were reached. There will be a new strategic cooperation agreement between the U.S. and Israel being negotiated. That was said in public after the talks by President Obama. That's a major step forward, something that Israel really wants. There'll be more support for the Iron Dome anti-missile system. I think, in effect, the Israelis were saying, you know, we can't stand this uranium enrichment that Iran is still doing. We can't wait forever for diplomacy and sanctions to work. And you got to give us something so we feel safer. You have to stay our hand. And in effect, I think the United States has agreed, some of it behind closed doors, to a lot more strategic cooperation. That's military aid and intelligence exchanges. And I think that this, to tell you the truth, is what both leaders wanted. Obama wanted to prevent the outbreak of a war in the Middle East. Israel attacking Iran could cause a war. And Israel's leader with his new coalition, he wants to look closer to Obama and have some real help also for Israeli intelligence and the military. I think both men are getting what they wanted.
But it's a bit hard for me to understand, Dan Raviv, how you could have statements about how Hezbollah getting hold of Syria's chemical weapons could lead to an epic tragedy that we cannot allow.
Yeah.
And at the same time, saying that the greatest danger facing the Middle East was a nuclear Iran. To some extent, it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been able to change the subject for a number of years.
Here's the main thing, Ian, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are well aware of it. We haven't even mentioned Jewish settlements in the West Bank. We've barely mentioned the Palestinian issue.
Well, that's what I was about to say. He's managed to change the subject.
Changing the subject, right?
Right. So,
and of course, Netanyahu does not want to have his public disputes with Obama about that. And President Obama, after his first session with Netanyahu, and there will be more talks tomorrow and Friday, after the first session, there was no mention of settlements. But this is important. Tomorrow, President Obama is going to speak to the Israeli people. He's going to give a speech kind of over Netanyahu's head at a convention center called Binyanei HaUma in Jerusalem, mainly to university students. Obama, I think, is going to urge the Israeli people to see that they have to make peace with the Palestinians, that it's worth it to make major concessions, because that's the way to guarantee that Israel can exist as a Jewish and democratic state. I think he was saving it for tomorrow instead of ending up in a clash with Netanyahu today.
And tomorrow he also meets with the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas.
I think that's just a courtesy call. The truth is that Abbas is not very popular with the Obama administration. You'll recall that a few months ago, Abbas, the Palestinian, insisted on going to the UN in New York and getting and winning a vote, raising the recognition level for the Palestinians in the UN, kind of an independence vote. It made the Palestinians feel good, but the U.S. did not like it one bit. And so I don't think, in fact, that President Obama has much to give the Palestinian leader. Meantime, the Palestinian leader is trying to reconcile with Hamas, the radicals in Gaza. I see it as a courtesy call. I don't think much is going to happen there, but I do think it's significant that when he comes back to Jerusalem and speaks to the Israelis, Obama will tell Israel, for your own sake, negotiate with the Palestinians and reach an agreement.
Well, Abbas has been criticized recently, and I think in off the cuff, nevertheless, I think it reflects what King Abdullah of Jordan feels, that he has a problem with Abbas in as much as he says he's obsessed with the Israelis, but he doesn't even deal with the Palestinians. And you remember the big data dump, the leak, I think, to Al Jazeera that indicated that the Palestinians basically have gotten nowhere in the negotiations and haven't been particularly effective. So it's like everybody's piling on Abbas.
You know, Ian, you might have thought that the only way to achieve some peace between Israel and Palestine is to create both countries, have negotiations toward that end. There's a growing faction in Israel that says, let's take some unilateral steps. Let's decide and declare what the border is. Let's give land to the Palestinian Authority, but these people say, let's keep some of the land we captured in 1967, where the Jewish settlers, you know, are in these thickly populated settlements. Let's keep them. Let's draw a border. I don't think that's going to work, but that is a growing faction in Israel where people are also sick of the dispute. By the way, President Obama is going to visit King Hussein in Jordan Friday, and then Mr. Obama is going to go to Petra, that great archaeological site in Jordan, on Saturday before flying home. And I just want to say this. It looks like it's all PR and all image. I have evidence for you that it's not. And here we are. Michelle Obama is not on the trip. And I don't say that as a joke. If the First Lady were there, where she's a rock star around the world, that would mean that it was mostly for show. So you'd listen to music and deal with artists and eat the food and all that. No, I think there's a lot of substance because the Middle East is at a critical time. And it is even helpful that Obama visits Jordan because the king's position isn't that stable. And this will help firm up King Abdullah in Jordan.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope I'm wrong.
yes, and by the way, we both might be right to a degree, because that's the Middle East for you, right? You get a little pattern where for 6 months things seem encouraging, and then it goes the other way, but we can't take our eye off the ball there. It's just too volatile.
So, Dan Raviv, you have obviously, with the books that you've done with Yossi Melman on intelligence, Israeli intelligence, and the relationship between the U.S. and Israel, the latest being Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, you would be the best person to answer a question I have, which is, what is this obsession that the Israelis have with Jonathan Pollard, with getting him out of jail? I mean,
a question of loyalty. In fact, I'll tell you. I mean, he's an American who was captured, arrested in Washington, D.C. in 1985. So he's been held for 28 years. He was found guilty of spying for the Israelis in Washington, D.C. He had access to secrets as a naval intelligence civilian worker. Okay, so he got a life sentence. He's, of course, been complaining about it, as has his family from the very beginning. For a while, Israel said nothing. They were ashamed at having been caught. In fact, they gave U.S. prosecutors quite a lot of evidence that went against Pollard. Well, in the last 10 years or so, Israeli governments feel really bad about that, and I really mean it on a human level. Israel has a tradition of going behind enemy lines, whatever is necessary, even trading 1,000 Palestinian prisoners to get one Israeli captured soldier released. And so they're seeing Pollard now as one of their guys who was captured in the United States, and Israel abandoned him, and the current Israeli government really wants to get him out. And there's a large movement in Israel calling for that. I don't think Obama's going to do it anytime soon. The CIA is dead set against it. But maybe in a while, as I say, Pollard, who's now 58 years old, has been in an American jail, a prison now, for 28 years.
Well, it's just that I brought it up because there are Israelis staging protests in Jerusalem demanding that President Obama free Jonathan Pollard. And more recently, I covered a story that involved an Australian Israeli who was disappeared into a secret prison where he committed suicide under mysterious circumstances.
Sure, I covered that too. And at IsraelSpy.com, my co-author and I write a lot about the Australian fella who was a Mossad operative who worked overseas and somehow did something against the agency where they locked him up. They were going to put him on trial, but before they could get to the trial, he apparently committed suicide in a high-security prison cell. A lot of shadowy stories about Israeli intel. In the case of Pollard, he's the only Israeli spy arrested in the U.S. ever, and the Israelis used to hate to talk about it, but now they've decided to publicly campaign and ask for his release. I don't think it'll happen now, but we'll see, maybe in the next few years.
But in terms of humanitarianism, there's a kind of irony there with Pollard and with the Australian fellow.
I take your point, but I did my best to check on the Australian case, and Israeli intelligence and the prosecutors and the Prime Minister's office did not want Ben Zigir to kill himself. They wanted to lock him up in secret, punish him for maybe 10 or 12 years in prison. That's the kind of sentence they had in mind for whatever his violation was. And no one is revealing what he did that made the Mossad so angry. But they were going to lock him up, and after 12 years, they thought they'd let him out. It's happened before. Instead, he foiled all that by killing himself.
So just in closing then, Dan Revie, back to the trip, which you've suggested there's quite a lot going on behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and it may be a very substantive, in effect, a working trip, not a PR trip.
I think so.
But what's going to be the takeaway? Because, you know, we've had this thing called a peace process, but it has little or nothing to do with peace. The agony goes on. At times, you know, you feel like this situation needs adult supervision. And the only adult in the room, or that could be in the room, is the United States. Mm-hmm. And we've had sort of fits and starts of American presidents getting things done over there, but mostly failing. So what's your prognosis on whether they can get a deal so that we don't have to keep talking about Israel all the time?
Well, Secretary of State John Kerry does plan to roll up his sleeves and get involved and meet with both Israeli and Palestinian leaders starting next week. And so there's no special envoy for the Obama administration, but there is the Secretary of State. I think he's going to rapidly find that that conditions are not ripe. The Palestinian movement is so divided, with Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the more moderate Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. I don't think there's anything there. As for Israelis, well, they have a new coalition government. It's a mix of people. Some are a little softer on keeping the West Bank. Some are more hardline and pro-settler. You don't have the extreme Orthodox Jewish parties in a coalition with Netanyahu anymore. He excluded them. So there are possibilities for change, but frankly, I don't think there's enough goodwill. And as for adult supervision, you cannot force the two sides. So right now, with all that's going on in the Middle East, including the Iranian nuclear threat, as it's perceived, especially by Israel, you're not going to find the Israeli government in a mood to make major concessions. And therefore, I'm afraid we're going to have stalemate still between Israel and the Palestinians.
But just in closing, though, just because we're observing the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War, what kind of soul searching is going on in Israel? Because there was tremendous support for George W. Bush and for that war initially, at least, although I did speak with the Israeli military historian Martin Van Creewald, who referred to the invasion of Iraq as the worst strategic mistake since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD. But given how much the chips have fallen in many ways and how unstable that region is as a result of that war, and it's likely to get worse, my understanding is that if Assad falls, it could have the ripple effect of ungluing what is being held together by a shoestring in Iraq.
Yeah, more volatility, as you say. Okay, here's the Israeli intelligence view of the Iraq war. They say that 10 years ago, the U.S. asked them a little bit for advice, and the Israeli advice was, this is really messy. You know, Bush, Cheney, you're a very friendly administration. You might not want to do this because it could end up strengthening Iran. But according to the Israelis, the Bush-Cheney team really was intent on doing it. So the Israelis said, yeah, well, we hate Saddam Hussein. You go ahead. All through the war in Iraq, the Israelis just really kept their distance. They sold some equipment, maybe, to help the U.S. Special Forces, but they kept their distance. The Israelis were thrilled when the U.S. got Osama bin Laden, and among other things, the Israelis would like the U.S. to keep fighting terrorists, keep fighting al-Qaeda. But yep, Iraq was a mistake, and it caused more instability. But Israelis say, we always live with instability. Every 10 years, it's a new picture. That, for a right-wing Israeli government, a guy like Prime Minister Netanyahu, is always the excuse for not making concessions. He says the whole neighborhood is too dangerous. So I expect Netanyahu to keep saying just that.
Well, Dan Raviv, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
I've been speaking with Dan Raviv, who's a national correspondent for CBS News and formerly CBS correspondent in Tel Aviv. He's the author of several books, including the 1990 bestseller Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, Friends Indeed Inside the U.S.-Israel Alliance, and his latest Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, all co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how student loan debt has now passed the $1 trillion mark.
So you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come with me.